have to somehow prevent people from watching the attack against them, which is very serious. It's serious on just straight economic grounds, but even more serious if you think of the other plans, like the militarization plans or the plans to destroy the environment, all of which may really literally bring the species to an end. But you certainly don't want people to pay attention to that, or the tax cuts for the rich, or you know, the other efforts to silence domestic independence. None of this is proper to look at.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on censorship, free speech, and the media. States want to dominate the narrative, its version of events. There are two basic models. One follows Aldous Huxley, the other George Orwell. The latter is best known for 1984. Big Brother is brutal. He wields a big stick, while Huxley uses a much softer carrot. Censorship is self-imposed, because the journalist knows the boundaries of permissible thought. Essential assumptions are embedded unconsciously, so they don't even rise to the level of being challenged. The Huxley model is more subtle and relies on persuasion. Orwell is straight-out coercion. Sing the tune I've told you to, or else. Our guest today is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar-activist who's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. Author of scores of books, among his latest are Consequences of Capitalism, Chronicles of Dissent, and Notes on Resistance. He spoke in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2002, at a special event marking the 25th anniversary of South End Press. In this never-before broadcast, Chomsky begins by recounting his own experience with censorship with his co-author Ed Herman. And now, Noam Chomsky.
Well, the late 70s, when South End got started, were kind of a low point in the opportunities to write and in other ways address general audiences. The major journals of the 1960s had collapsed. Ramparts and Liberation were gone, a couple others. There had been a few mainstream journals that had been open to dissident opinion, but those options had been mostly closed. There were some publishing opportunities, but they were pretty limited. When South End came along, later Z Magazine, that made quite a substantial difference and a major contribution to the growing popular movement. Just on a personal note, the first couple of books that I published with South End, first one was with Ed Herman, Political Economy of Human Rights. The next one was Fateful Triangle. Others, later years, Political Economy of Human Rights was 1979. Both of those books had sort of interesting histories which reflect the nature of the times. Ed and I had, in fact, written an earlier version of Political Economy of Human Rights. It was published by a mainstream publisher in 1974, but the publisher was owned by a conglomerate, Warner Communications, which is now part of Time, AOL, Warner, some bigger thing, I lost track. They published 20,000 copies of it. A couple of ads came out. A senior executive of the corporation saw the ads and didn't like them, took a look at the book, and flew out the window or something like that, ordered the publisher to terminate publication. They refused. There was a long hassle. The end result was that the conglomerate put the publisher out of business, destroyed not only that book, but all their stock totally. That was not considered a free speech issue in the United States. None of the free speech advocates thought there was anything wrong with this. After all, it's not state censorship, it's just corporate censorship, and that doesn't interfere with freedom of speech. So the fact that a publisher was put totally out of business, all their books destroyed to prevent distribution of a single book, has barely been mentioned. In fact, about the only person I can think of who's mentioned it is Ben Bagdikian, and his media monopoly, the various editions of that, has brought it up. It was brought to the attention of people who are very active in writing about free speech, but they correctly, from their point of view, said there's no issue. Well, that tells you something not only about the times, but about the principles. Southend came along, and we were able to publish a much expanded edition of it. There's a principle of journalism, which is you never mention anything that departs from the party line. You got to keep to that rigidly. So you won't find mentions of it in the mainstream, but the material's there. The second book also has an interesting history. I happened to think about this history a couple days ago when I was reading the New York Review. There was an article there by the head of the Center for Human Rights at the Kennedy School, Carr Center, about genocide and about the failure of the United States to deter genocide. What's wrong with us that makes it so difficult for us to deter genocide when we see it? If you look at the examples, you can figure out the operational meaning of the term genocide. It means some crime that we can attribute to others. It doesn't matter what crime it was very much. In fact, you can say anything you like about it. You can make up stories or anything you want. But as long as we're not involved in it or we're not implementing it, then it can count as genocide. And many examples are given. For example, the fact that allegation that the Serbians carried out mass murder of 200,000 people in the early 90s. Just as a research project, you might want to look up the scholarly literature to find the sources for that. But it really doesn't matter. As long as you're criticizing someone else, it's fine. Don't need any evidence. Say anything you want. And it qualifies as genocide. There are other cases of, just since the number is given, of 200,000 people killed where the evidence is actually much better, but they're not mentioned. One of them, in fact, is discussed in Political Economy of Human Rights. By that time, the United States, and with Britain's help, had succeeded in killing off about 200,000 people in East Timor, but that doesn't count because we did it. So therefore, it doesn't enter the annals of genocide. I don't use the term much myself, but in that case, it may be legitimate. That was maybe a third or a quarter of the population, and it got much worse. Later, the United States and Britain continued to support the slaughter right through the bitter end, mid-September 1999. But that doesn't count because it violates a principle. We were responsible for it consciously with eyes open. Therefore, it couldn't be reported, and it doesn't enter the history of genocide. There was another case which we couldn't mention in that book because it was just about beginning then. We talked about the early stages. Another 200,000 people in Central America, roughly, for which the United States is directly responsible. Therefore, that doesn't enter. And we can list lots of others. But some do enter when you can claim with whatever evidence, in this case none, that 200,000 people were killed by an official enemy. One case that is discussed in the article where the term genocide is indeed commonly used and with some justification is the case of Cambodia, which we also discussed in that book. There the term is not unreasonable. In fact, there is one governmental study, study by a government, an independent government, of what happened in Cambodia. As far as I'm aware, the only place where it's ever discussed is in work that Ed and I did. The reason is because of the title, which gives it away. It's called The Decade of Genocide. This was the government of Finland, incidentally, carried out a study of what they called The Decade of Genocide, 1969 to 1979. But since it's the decade of genocide, it can't be mentioned because that includes the years 1969 to 1975 when the United States was responsible for the atrocities and the massacres. So therefore, that's out in order just to reconstitute the destruction. But that's all out of history because of the same principle. It's attributed to the wrong agent. What's in history is what fits, what doesn't matter whether it happened, but as long as it sort of fits the story that's within history. I won't talk about the other book, Fateful Triangle, because I don't want to harp on this, but let me just mention that those two books, first ones of mine that happened to be published by South End, they're both about topics which are right in the headlines now, international terrorism and West Asia, what's called the Middle East, and countries that are committed to a kind of a Eurocentric bias. Elsewhere in the world, it's called West Asia properly. And of course, they're all over the headlines today, both of those topics. Say this morning's front page headlines tell you about new plans for nuclear war fighting, which are justified on the basis of the threat of international terrorism. There are other things that they don't tell you, however. One thing that they don't tell you is that the plans aren't new. In fact, they're old. It's true that they're a little bit modified, but they've been around for a long time, even if the press and the journals decided it wasn't a nice idea to publish them, though they knew about them. The plans were initiated in March 1990, immediately after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which made it very clear that there is no longer any deterrent. Okay, that was the crucial thing that took place in, when the Berlin Wall fell and sort of the end of the junior superpower. So now there's no deterrent, and Pentagon war planning changed very quickly by a couple of months later, by March 1990. Well, this is public, incidentally. It shifted from what's called planning to attack what's called in Pentagon jargon a weapons-rich environment, that's the Soviet Union, they're weapons-rich, to a target-rich environment, which is the rest of the world. It's not weapons-rich, but target-rich. Primarily what's called the South, that's not a geographical term, that means anybody outside of the United States and its clients and allies. So the target, the South, the pretext shifted from the Russians are coming, which had been the pretext up until November 1989, to a new reason, namely the technological sophistication of third world powers. That's why we needed this huge military system, including a nuclear system, which did have to be modified, because now that we were now that it was aimed at a target-rich environment, you needed different kind of devices, mini-nukes and so on. In fact, the kind that are being discussed in the new nuclear plans that are being added now. It has to be targeted what they called smaller countries capable of producing weapons of mass destruction. Well, who is capable of producing weapons of mass destruction? Any country that has a high school chemistry laboratory is capable of producing weapons of mass destruction. In fact, it's not that hard. So that's a pretty broad category. And they're to be targeted with nuclear weapons, including mini-nukes. It's true that there's a change. The new programs that are on the front page now do apparently intensify what had already existed. And it is true that it's under the pretext of international terrorism, but I think the word pretext should be stressed. It was going on when there was no pretext of international terrorism, though it's worth remembering that the reason we, in 1979, that Ed Herman and I talked about state terrorism is because it was one of the major problems of the world. And within a year, 2 years, it had become the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy. The War on Terror, so-called, was declared 20 years ago in very much the same terms it is today, and it's been redeclared periodically since without very much change. The 200,000 corpses in Central America are one of the indices of what that war has meant. Topics which would be discussed, in fact, headlined, if there was a press or journals that were interested in the topic of the war on terror for pretty obvious reasons. It's not ancient history. And in fact, the same people are involved who were carrying out the so-called war on terror then. The intensification of the nuclear weapons programs, that's the headlines on the front pages today, is part of a larger story September 11th was also used as a pretext to sharply escalate other military programs. In my opinion, the most dangerous of them is the militarization of space program, which has also been going on for years. It's under the rubric of missile defense. But whenever you hear the word defense, what you should understand is offense. And in fact, both adversaries and advocates recognize that even the small component called missile defense is an offensive weapon. There's no dispute about that. The goal is quite explicit. Again, you can read it in high-level government documents, Clinton's Space Command, or strategic analysts who write in major journals. The goal is what they call hegemony, that is protecting U.S. commercial interests and investments, and the analogies given to navies in earlier years, which had the same purpose, but now we go on to the next frontier, space, and that one the U.S. all monopolized, assumed, because it's so far ahead that there won't be any competitors. Well, in order to monopolize it, you have to have massive offensive capacities. Everybody realizes this. They have to be on hair trigger alert. That raises very rapidly the risk of destruction, quite apart from calling forth responses from others. And that's understood. There's no disagreement that all of this raises the risks seriously, just as the current plans do. That's understood, too. But it really doesn't matter. In this case, it happens to be total destruction. You know, so like anything goes wrong, it's finished. It doesn't matter much because hegemony, the announced goal, is much more highly valued than survival under the governing values. Nothing particularly novel about that. It's the scale of the consequences that's novel. Well, that, again, is what ought to be in the headlines, including the background. It's not new. It's greatly enhanced under the pretext of international terrorism and a very vulgar exploitation of the fear and concern of the population, which offers a kind of window opportunity to ram through all sorts of programs that powerful systems want to implement but can't if the public's paying attention. What's the connection of all of this to terrorism? Well, approximately zero. There are terrorist threats to the United States. There's no doubt about that, and plenty of terrorist threats to the rest of the world. But just keeping to threats to the United States, they're real. Some of them were on the front pages, too, in the last couple of days. Here's Xeroxed a couple. New York Times had a front page story on March 7th about a real threat, namely what are called dirty bombs, radioactive materials that are in wide use in the United States could be turned into, at least theoretically, it's not easy to do in practice, but could in principle be turned into weapons of terror that might kill few people. But even though only a few people would be killed, they would spread panic and produce severe economic damage. What they're talking about is bars of radioactive cobalt, which are used to irradiate food and medical devices and various other things like that. Well, how does, say, missile defense or nuclear weapons deal with that? Well, you can figure it out. And there are plenty of other dangers of that kind, but they're not addressed by the new military systems, nor are they intended to be. But we kind of like anniversaries, as you know, and this happens to be the 40th anniversary this month of John F. Kennedy's initial use of chemical weapons in South Vietnam. The authorization of chemical weapons in South Vietnam was actually earlier. It was in November 1961 that the client regime using U.S. helicopters was equipped with facilities for using for chemical warfare. And in March 1962, it was publicly announced that U.S. pilots were flying planes that were involved in strafing and combat missions against the South Vietnamese. The goal was to destroy the economy and social fabric of areas where the population was resisting the regime that the United States had installed, the client regime. There was no pretense of anybody else around except South Vietnamese. Also at that same time, around March 62, Kennedy started clandestine operations against North Vietnam, but that was kind of like a fringe operation. The attack was mainly against the South. By 1962, U.S. air and firepower in South Vietnam exceeded the peak that had been reached by France in its war against Indochina to try to recover it 10 years earlier, which the U.S. had indeed backed. And occasionally there's some mention of this. Boston Globe, as far as I'm aware, the only newspaper in the United States that mentioned wire service reports. There are a lot of wire service reports that came out this month about a meeting going on in Vietnam where the leading U.S., one of the leading U.S. specialists on the topic, a professor at of the School of Public Health at the University of Texas, released his studies on blood tests of people in South Vietnam who were living near areas where the U.S. had used chemical warfare, Agent Orange, intensively, and found dioxin levels about 200 times above the average, what he called startlingly high levels of cancer-causing dioxin. Well, this is only South Vietnam, incidentally. North Vietnam was spared this particular atrocity. Although it's front page news that somebody might figure out a way to cause few deaths but a lot of panic in the United States with chemical weapons, it's no news at all that we're now commemorating the 40th anniversary of our massive use of chemical warfare with unknown consequences against South Vietnam, one part of an extremely murderous war, which also doesn't enter the discussion of genocide. Notice never mentioned. Again, on the same principle, wrong agent, therefore a wrong story. What's the scale of the deaths just from cancer and the birth deformities and so on in South Vietnam? Well, nobody knows, because another principle is you don't investigate your own crimes. You only make claims about other people's crimes and posture grandly about how awful they are and how marvelous we are. So nothing's known in detail, but there has been some reporting. One of the top Israeli reporters, Amnon Kapeliuk, wrote and went to South Vietnam in 1988 and wrote a series of stories in the Hebrew press there in which he estimated, as far as he could figure out, that there were about 250,000 victims of cancer and what he called hideous birth deformities, described mutilated fetuses and so on and so forth. I don't know if the number, again, it's only South Vietnam. That was 1988. What, they're still going on. The person I just cited says, yes, there's still new cases, some of them years after the termination of the chemical warfare. But it's basically none of our business when you write articles about our failure to deter genocide when carried out by others. You don't talk about our casual implementation of mass murder because we're entitled to do that. That's our métier, more or less. So why talk about it? Actually, there are some reports about it. I don't want to say it's never discussed. About 10 years ago, the New York Times did have a report by Barbara Crissett in its science section on this topic, in which she pointed out that the United States is really missing an important opportunity by not studying the effects of its chemical warfare in Vietnam. The reason is that there's an almost perfect control situation. The North people in the North and the South have approximately the same genes, no difference between them, but only the South, which was the main target of the U.S. attack all through, was subjected to chemical warfare. So therefore, if we sort of overcame our irrational unwillingness to study the problem, we might look at this control populations and learn something that would be useful to us. And therefore, it's really silly not to investigate it. You can check the article and see if there's any other reason to investigate it. The idea that we might do something about it is, of course, so outlandish that nobody can even mention it, like reparations, for example. It's quite the contrary. They have to pay reparations to us. The Vietnam was required to take over the debt of the client government to the United States in order to be allowed to enter the world system. That means they were required to pay the costs of conquering and destroying South Vietnam before they're allowed to enter the world system, and that was considered quite reasonable as well, and doesn't enter any discussions about, you know, international terrorism or deterring genocide or anything else. So when this stuff was going on, you couldn't get two people in a room to talk about it. In fact, it was years before any protest developed. In fact, the protest level was so low right through to the end, right until the day, that nobody even knows that we attacked South Vietnam, although we certainly did. As I said, this is the 40th anniversary of the public announcement of it, and it went on to horrendous proportions. But since there was no protest at all, it's just disappeared from history. 5 or 6 years later, a protest did develop. I mean, by that time, you know, nobody knows how many hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered in South Vietnam, millions of refugees, country half destroyed, war had expanded to the rest of Indochina. By then, it was possible to get some protests. And among the public, it turned out there were substantial protests by the end of the 1960s. But contrary to everything you read, there was almost no protest among educated people. It was virtually non-existent. And you can see how low it is by looking at the way it's dealt with right today. So a couple of years ago, a book came out by Robert McNamara, which you probably, I'm sure, know of. It's In Retrospect. And the reaction to the book was kind of interesting. The book was criticized by the hawks because it was treachery, and welcomed by the doves. That's the interesting part. It was welcomed almost across the board by the doves as vindicating their stand. Well, how did McNamara vindicate their stand? He vindicated it by saying that, by apologizing, not to the Vietnamese, there's no apology to them, but by apologizing to the American people for having caused them a lot of problems, because he didn't come clean early enough about the difficulties there would be in conquering South Vietnam. And he should have been more honest about that, and he apologized for that error. So that vindicates the position of the doves as they themselves see it. You know, and that's correct. That's approximately what the level of the criticism was among educated sectors, sort of comparable to what you might have found among, say, German generals after Stalingrad, when there was criticism of Hitler for tactical errors in fighting a two-front war and in not coming clean to the German people about how difficult it was going to be to win under those conditions. Among educated sectors, that's called criticism. And they're now surprised that there isn't such a fantastic level of criticism today, although even that was after 6 or 7 years of attacking South Vietnam.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky, Censorship, Free Speech, and the Media. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Well, the fact of the matter is the 60s had a civilizing effect on the general population. And no president could dream of doing what Kennedy could easily get away with 40 years ago, or what could even be done 20 years ago. There's just way too much opposition. It's much deeper, it's much broadly spread through the population, right through the mainstream, that's a serious impediment to violence. Not anywhere near enough, but it's certainly better than it was in the past. In fact, I can't remember any time, at least in where there's been so much protest over involving an international conflict at anything like a comparable stage. Certainly the Vietnam War was radically different. Well, let's turn to the current situation. I won't talk much about international terrorism. There's a lot to say about it. Let's take a look at West Asia. What's going on there? Well, there are two main foci of attention. One is the Israel-Palestine conflict, the other's pending war in Iraq. Let's take a look at the first. And, well, actually, let's borrow a phrase from our leader, who is very worried about what he calls enhancing terror in Israel and Palestine, blaming it primarily on the Palestinians, in fact, almost all. So how do you go about enhancing terror in the Israel-Palestine conflict? Well, the United States gave a good illustration of how to do this in December, last December. There was a Security Council debate over a resolution initiated by the European Union calling for measures to implement the U.S. Mitchell Plan to reduce the level of violence by the obvious means, namely introducing international monitors. That's a good way to lower the level of violence. Worked elsewhere, could work there. The U.S. vetoed the resolution. It then immediately went to the General Assembly, where the U.S. voted against it, along with Israel. And usually the U.S. and Israel vote alone against such resolutions, or in fact most resolutions. But in this case, the U.S. did pick up another couple of countries, a few Pacific islands, so it wasn't alone in enhancing terror. I had some allies. When the U.S. votes against something, it's not only vetoed, but vetoed from the public record, so there's virtually no mention of this in the press, and it'll disappear from history. This was an important period because it was right in the middle of a 21-day period of what is called quiet in the Israel-Palestine conflict, which means only Palestinians were killed. About 20 Palestinians were killed, about half of them children, but there was no very little other violence, so it was a period of quiet, and that's when the U.S. intervened to enhance terror in this fashion, very efficient way to do it. It wasn't the only example. 10 days earlier, on December 5th, there was an important meeting in Switzerland, which was also vetoed from history. You can search and you won't find any discussion of it, very little discussion. This was a meeting of the high contracting parties of the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Conventions were established right after the Second World War to formally criminalize the crimes of the Nazis. That was their purpose. The Fourth Geneva Convention dealt with occupied territories, this was a meeting of, there are what are called high contracting parties, that is parties which, of course the United States is one, which are bound by solemn treaty to act to enforce the conventions in any circumstances. The meeting was in Switzerland because Switzerland is the country that's the repository for dealing with this. Every country in the world, with the exception of Israel, literally holds that the Geneva Conventions apply to the occupied territories. Furthermore, it is international law. It's been reiterated at the Security Council without a negative vote. So, for example, in October 2001, the Security Council voted without a veto, without a negative vote, that the Geneva Conventions do apply to the occupied territories. The vote was 14-0, but with one abstention. The United States abstains on those votes. It does not want to come out openly opposing the conventions that were instituted to criminalize the crimes of the Nazis, so it therefore abstains, which kills them, keeps them out of the press and the historical record, and of course makes them inapplicable. That same thing happened on December 5th of last year. The United States boycotted the meeting, so it's finished. Didn't matter that every participant voted for a strong resolution holding that the Geneva Conventions apply to the occupied territories, which entails that virtually everything the United States is doing there, meaning Israel's doing with U.S. arms, weapons, economic aid, diplomatic support, that's all illegal. Illegal means technically what's called a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, which is a war crime by any standard. But it doesn't matter. The U.S. boycotted it, so therefore it's out of the discussion. And the possibility of reducing the level of violence by the means supported by the entire world in this case, U.S. accepted, are out of the discussion. That's not the only case. This includes all the settlements, you know, that the U.S. pays for, our tax dollars pay for them, that the U.S. protects with military aid, diplomatic support, and so on. It's all gone. If you read this morning's papers, you see that very happy that the Israeli prime minister made what's called a concession. Namely, he's allowing Yasser Arafat to leave his little prison, the room to which he's been confined for the last couple of months, just in order to make sure everybody understands what this is. Yesterday, what's called Israel. When you hear about Israeli helicopters attacking something, that means U.S. helicopters, right? Israel doesn't produce helicopters or F-16s. So when you read Israeli helicopters attacked something with missiles, that means U.S. helicopters provided to Israel for that purpose, with the certain knowledge that that's what they're going to be used for. In this case, a couple days ago, they wiped out the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority had been constructing in Gaza for potential state headquarters. There's no significance to this other than humiliation, which is the core principle for dealing with the lower breeds. Every Westerner understands this. You got to humiliate them, not just kill them, but humiliate them. It's very important. But now Israel, meaning the United States, made a concession. It's allowing Arafat to get out of his prison, to which he's been confined. The reason for letting him out is allegedly that they arrested some people who Israel wants him to arrest for killing an Israeli minister, Minister Ze'evi, tourist minister. That's considered a crime. Of course, it is a crime. And the crime is not absolved by the fact that it was retaliation for an earlier crime, a couple of weeks earlier, namely the murder of Abu Ali Mustafa, who's the first political leader, pure, straight political leader, to have been purposely assassinated in this conflict. He was assassinated by what's called an Israeli helicopter, meaning a U.S. helicopter, and introduced political, straight political assassination for the first time. Ze'evi was a retaliation. But the Abu Ali Mustafa assassination isn't a crime. In fact, you might explore to see how that's been covered here. It's not a crime, and nobody is confined to his room because he didn't arrest the people responsible for that crime, which obviously wouldn't make any sense anyway, because everyone knows who's responsible. They're sitting in the White House and in the government offices in Tel Aviv, so you don't have to confine them in any rooms. You know exactly who they are. It's not a question. You don't have to search for them. But it doesn't count on the same principles that I've been mentioning. Who sent the helicopters? Well, for that we can primarily credit Bill Clinton, although Bush has been continuing too. Just to remind you, the current conflict, the Al-Aqsa Intifada, actually began on September 29th of the year 2000. I'm virtually quoting the U.S. Mitchell report at this point, when the Israeli government, the day after Sharon had entered the Al-Aqsa compound, the mosque, with a big entourage of military as a pure provocation and no other purpose. The day after that, Prime Minister Barak surrounded it with about 1,000 soldiers, and when people came out of the mosque and some kids started throwing stones, they shot at them. Before it was over, half a dozen people were killed, and that took off from there. On the first day, October 1st, September 30th, October 1st, October 2nd, Israel began using U.S. helicopters to attack civilian targets, apartment complexes, others, killing a couple dozen people. On October 3rd, Clinton made the biggest deal in a decade to send Israel new helicopters, biggest deal in a decade, including spare parts for Apache attack helicopters that had been sent a couple of weeks earlier. Well, that's a terrific way of enhancing terror. There was no Palestinian fire at that time. You know, it was just stone throwing. But as soon as our client state, offshore military base, starts using our attack helicopters to murder civilians, the way to enhance terror is obviously to send them more. Well, that's the government. The press can also cooperate in enhancing terror, namely by not reporting it. And they didn't. So if you check, you discover that although this is perfectly public knowledge, like you read in the Israeli press or the military journals and so on, the press refused to report it. Notice I'm not saying failed to report it, but rather refused, because it was specifically brought to the attention of editors of leading journals, and they essentially said this is not the right story. So to this day, it hasn't been reported except, you know, in the dissident press. Bush continued when he came into office, and so you have Israeli, what are called Israeli helicopters, meaning our helicopters, carrying out assassinations and other atrocities. How many have there been? Well, according to the Israeli press, they say 48 people have been assassinated, liquidated, they say, without a trial, and another 26 happened to be killed who were at the site of the liquidations. The Palestinian Human Rights Group gives the figure of 66, but let's keep to the Israeli figures. So 48 killed and 26 others just happened to be around. There were more yesterday, incidentally, so it goes on. And the reporter, Gidon Levy in Haaretz, gives a lot of shocking examples. But it's not, and he also points out, the occasion for his article is that there was a protest to the High Court, an appeal to the High Court, like the Supreme Court, to rule against targeted assassination, a lot of them with helicopters. And the court denied the request, saying that it saw no reason to put an end to these assassinations. So there's no, as Levy points out, there's no way to appeal to anyone in Israel. All they can do is appeal to an international tribunal, since the Israeli government, meaning the U.S. government, because remember, they can act up to the point where the U.S. authorizes it, not an inch beyond. So these will go on. What about diplomacy? Well, there is some talk about diplomacy. Right now, there's a lot of talk about a Saudi Arabian plan. There's been a lot of reporting about this. Some of the reporting, including the Globe, did point out, and they're right to do so, that this is sort of similar to a plan that Saudi Arabia put forth in 1981, the Fahd plan. In fact, it's virtually identical to it. But that plan, according to the reports, was killed by the Arab states who didn't want to make peace with Israel. Well, that's not quite exact, so I'll just quote from the second book that South End was nice enough to publish for me, Fateful Triangle. This is 1983, right after the first plan came along. Here's what actually happened. Try to search for it in the press. Shimon Peres, the leading dove, said that the Saudi Arabian plan threatened Israel's very existence. The Labor Party's official newspaper said that the Israeli government, in reaction to the Saudi peace plan, had sent military aircrafts over Saudi Arabia, effectively warning the United States that if the United States showed any interest in this plan, they'd blow up the oil fields. So it's a threat to the United States with U.S. Phantom jets, incidentally. That's not an unusual conjuncture that's been going on for a while. They didn't have to worry about it because the U.S. wasn't going to allow the plan anyway, but they were worried. The Labor Party Journal described this reaction, Israeli reaction, as so irrational as to cause foreign intelligence services to get out of their files their plans about Israeli bombing of the Saudi oil fields. Amos Elon, a very distinguished correspondent, described it as shocking, the Israeli reaction as shocking, frightening, if not downright despair-producing. And similar comments go over to the center-right. Yoel Marcus condemned what he called the frightened, almost hysterical response to the Saudi plan. He said it's a grave mistake. Israel's president, Chaim Herzog, Labor dove, he wrote about it. He said the real author of the Saudi plan is the PLO. And he added that he said that the plan that the PLO, the Saudi PLO plan, was even more extreme than a Security Council resolution of January 1976, which he says was prepared by the PLO. He was at that time Israel's UN ambassador. The plan, and there was such a proposal at the Security Council, it was proposed by the Arab confrontation states, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. It was, in fact, backed by the entire world, by the Russians, Europe, Latin America, all the Arab states, everyone. It was vetoed by the United States, which, as usual, means vetoed from history. So that's not, none of this is discussed. What did the plan call for? Well, it called for the full implementation of official U.S. policy, that is UN 242, which calls for recognized borders and the right of every state to live in peace and security and so on, but with a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. There were then subsequent plans from Saudi Arabia and other Arab states, Europe and others, all blocked by the United States, up to the 1981 plan, which caused such hysteria. Actually, Herzog's comments were not correct. The Saudi Arabian plan was not any different from the January 76 plan, and his claim that both of them were prepared by the PLO is almost certainly false, but it is a reflection of the hysteria among Israeli doves over the threat that there might be a peace proposal that maybe the U.S. would take seriously, although there was very little chance of that because the U.S. was strongly opposed to a peaceful diplomatic settlement and has in fact succeeded in blocking any such settlement for the past 25 years, which again would be headlines if there was any interest in anything but enhancing terror. Well, was in fact the U.S. reaction? Actually, we don't really know that in detail because nothing's ever reported. Since the U.S. is blocking peace and enhancing violence, it just can't be reported. And this continues up to the very present. When the first Saudi plan was proposed, the Fahd plan, in August 1981, that was right at the time when Israel, with U.S. backing, Israel was beginning to plan the invasion of Lebanon, which took place the following summer. The purpose of the invasion of Lebanon, and the reason for the invasion of Lebanon, it was perfectly open in Israel, to try to prevent the PLO from continuing its extremely annoying policies of trying to move towards a diplomatic settlement, which Israel doesn't really mind terror much, but they do mind negotiations and diplomacy, because that might mean you have to relinquish the occupied territories. Terror you can kind of deal with. So the idea was to try to prevent the PLO from pursuing these efforts by just driving them out of Lebanon. That was the goal. Finally, I have to give credit where it's due, it finally reached the American press after 20 years of perfectly clear information. I mean, if you take a look at Fateful Triangle, a lot of quotes from the Israeli top Israeli officials and Israeli press and many more in the following years, but it did reach the New York Times on January 24th of this year. The James Bennett has an article in which he points out accurately that the Israeli government's goal in invading Lebanon and incidentally killing about 20,000 people, the goal was to install a friendly regime and destroy Mr. Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization. That, the theory went, would help persuade Palestinians to accept Israeli rule in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. That's accurate. And it's nice that after 20 years, it finally made it to a kind of a, you know, line inside a story which nobody will notice. But at least it's there. So now we can quote the New York Times. We don't have to quote massive documentation from the Israeli press and the and journals and the dissident press here. All of that's, notice that that's a textbook illustration of international terrorism, right? It's the use of force to try to attain political goals by intimidation and fear. Actually, it goes way beyond international terrorism. It's a war crime for which you have Nuremberg trials, but it's at least international terrorism. In fact, a major case of it. Backing by the United States all the way right to the present. Well, that's just a sample of what ought to appear in the press if we want to understand what's going on there, small sample. And unless we're willing to face realities like that, there's no point even pretending to be talking about what's happening. Well, that's one aspect of West Asia. What about, I'll end with the next one, what about the axis of evil, the next phase in the war of terror? First question is why George Bush's speechwriters decided to pick that phrase, axis of evil. I presume the reason for using the word evil is because it plays to the domestic audience. At least you can reduce them to the level of children reading fairy tales. So if you can sort of frighten people enough so they kind of huddle under the shadow of the heroic leader, maybe you can get them to think that the hero, semi-divine hero, is protecting them from evil, you know, like you remember when you were a kid, or ancient epics, although they at least have the literary quality. It's different from the plagiarism. And it's very important to do that. Because you have to somehow prevent people from watching the attack against them, which is very serious. It's serious on just straight economic grounds, but even more serious if you think of the other plans, like the militarization plans or the plans to destroy the environment, all of which may really literally bring the species to an end. But you certainly don't want people to pay attention to that, or the tax cuts for the rich, or, you know, the other efforts to silence domestic independence. None of this is proper to look at. And the best way to keep people from looking at it is to have them huddling in terror. So there's big evil out there. What about the axis? I suppose the people who wrote the words know, even if Bush doesn't know what the word axis refers to. There was an axis. But it surely doesn't apply to Iran and Iraq and North Korea. I mean, Iran and Iraq have been at war for 20 years, and North Korea's got nothing to do with it. So whatever it is, it's not an axis. But again, that has the kind of right flavor. It suggests the Nazis and, you know, German troops marching all over the world and so on. Of the whole axis of evil, there's one component of it which may actually be implemented. Namely an attack on Iraq. And there are reasons for that. We know for certain that the reasons have nothing to do with Saddam Hussein's crimes. The reason we know that is that during the period of his worst crimes, by far, the U.S. and Britain were supporting him and continued to support him right through the atrocities and afterwards for several years because they didn't care. That included his development of weapons of mass destruction with the assistance of U.S. and British aid, dual technology assistance, which could be applied to weapons of mass destruction, as they knew. And back at that time, in the late 80s, he really was a threat, much more so than now. You know, now Iraq's very much weakened, but then it was a real threat. So we know for certain that can't be the reason. I mean, you'll hear over and over again, as you've been hearing for a long time, that we can't let this guy survive because ultimate criminal, you know, did all these terrible things, gassed his own people, etc. All of which is true, just missing three little words, namely, with our support, you know, which continued. So whatever the reasons may be, it's not those reasons that we can be confident about. What are the reasons? Well, it's not very hard to figure out. Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. He'd be quite confident that one way or another, the U.S. is going to act to regain control over those oil reserves and their distribution and sale, and to deny them to adversaries. At the moment, France and Russia have a kind of like a privileged access to them, along with Dick Cheney and his company, incidentally, but the U.S. doesn't have privileged access to them and control over them, so something will be done to rectify that, and it's possible that they think that, you know, this is an opportunity to somehow achieve this. Just this morning, the Globe reports, probably correctly, a split between CIA and State Department on one hand and the Pentagon on the other as to who to use to try to restore the system of U.S. control. The CIA and the State Department are dealing with Iraqi generals, who in fact include the ones responsible for the Halabja chemical warfare and other atrocities. But that's okay, because remember, it really wasn't the atrocities or the development of weapons of mass destruction that was a problem. It was disobedience. It's a real problem. Well, that brings us up to the present. Obviously, a lot more to say, but it illustrates very well the kind of contribution that institutions like South End and others like it, many have spawned from it, in fact, can make. They offer ways in which the public can discover what's going on in the world, that includes domestically and internationally, even if it violates the principles. The principle that you only pretend to be upset about other people's crimes, you obscure your own, you eliminate from history anything that doesn't fit nicely. And these are really important things for people to understand, not just intellectually, even if they're just interested in simple things like survival, because at this point that's really threatened.
That was Noam Chomsky on censorship, free speech, and the media. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2002 on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of South End Press. South End stopped publishing a few years ago, but many of its titles have been reissued by Haymarket Books. Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist, is America's leading dissident intellectual. He's the author of scores of books, including two I did with him, Notes on Resistance and Chronicles of Dissent. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. Since its inception, we've made a special effort to record and archive Professor Chomsky's work. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Noam Chomsky on Censorship, Free Speech, and the Media, and for his books, Notes on Resistance and Chronicles of Dissent, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go to our website, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Martin Folker. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.